The following presentation, Surviving a DDoS Attack, was given by Matt Johnson of EduServe at NetWorkshop 42 in April 2014.
I can still the name of the customer for the reasons, but most of it is a bit of bad intelligence. So where I'm going to structure the talk today, and a tiny bit of background about EduServe, because I'm sure some people might not know who we are. A brief diary of the actual attack itself, some profiles on what the attack was, analysis of how we
responded to that attack.
Please feel free to interrupt at any time with questions. So, very briefly, EduServe, we're a charity. We provide IT services, mainly hosting, identity management, and license negotiations for government, education, and charities. Most of our services are delivered at our Swindon Data Centre, but we operate DR facilities in Swindon, and we've been doing it since 96. In terms of our IT customer base, about 20 across a range of markets, but some of the government customers we have are particularly high profile. So day one, we saw the initial attack Sunday 13th of May. It was around 2 hours long. We think it was TCP based, polymetric, probably HTTP, from Brazil and Canada. And you can see
the spike there, that's the inbound traffic. The attack was claimed via Twitter, so we knew what was happening, but we didn't actually make any corrections. They basically stopped. Strange, but there you are. So day two, the second attack, day after, and this attack was coordinated across a range of government websites, not just the one we were hosting. This time it's UDP paste, probably DNS amplification, a range of source addresses this time, and it probably took the majority of our government customer infrastructure down for about an hour. You can see the sort of spike you're looking at in terms of traffic compared to a normal traffic profile. In this situation, the way we mitigated was, in effect, to readdress and blackhole the address block that was being targeted. So, in effect, we sacrificed the one website to save the rest of them. I'll explain why we did that rather than alternative methods in a minute. So, day three, we tried to bring the site back online on a completely separate link to segregate it from other people. Again, it resumed straight away the attack. And it was a continued attack this time. So you can see just at the bottom edge of that graph is a typical traffic profile for that website. The attack beforehand was quite a bit more significant, as you can imagine. It wasn't helped by the fact that the website we were hosting was a third-party site that was developed, probably not according to best practice. Wasn't the best designed website in the world, and certainly wasn't designed to handle the scale of traffic that the DDoS produced. So there we are. In terms of the attack methods, there's a range of attack methods used, and they varied throughout the life cycle of the attack. So people heard of low orbit ion cannon, high orbit ion cannon, pretty basic attacks, which are HTTP requests. The main difference between low orbit and high orbit is the fact that there's some additional scripting in there. To change things like the HTTP browser refer and so on. The slightly more clever ones, DNS amplification, and the main one, in fact, that caused the problems was HTTP idle, where you open a connection but don't shut it down. That causes a lot of problems. In terms of the scale of the attack, we estimate at peak it was in excess of 5 gigabits. May not be a problem for some organizations running Janet, but for commercial links, which this was, unless you're one of the really, really big cloud providers, it's quite expensive at that scale. And again, not a huge number of requests, 200 per second, but when the site normally averaged 2 or 3, you can see it was a fairly big deal. And one of the main issues we faced was the lack of support or rapid support from our upstream ISP. Once you've got a denial of service going on and your main link is flooded, or one of your links is flooded, it's very, very difficult to actually do anything. Even if you put checks in at your firewalls and your routers, the traffic is saturating the link at that point. You need to work upstream of that to start blocking and filtering. That requires somebody responsive. Otherwise, your hands are tied. So while this was going on, we were tracking to try and figure out what was happening. Don't underestimate social media as a way of finding out what's happening. a lot of attackers like to promote their work in speech marks, and it can give an early insight into what's happening, sometimes the reasons why. But don't believe everything you read. So this is one of the quotes that from an interview afterwards. Apparently there are 75,000 computers attacking. Based on our log files, it was about 10,000. So a slight exaggeration there. Tango Down was a familiar cry at that stage. It was a rallying call that they seemed to use and spread widely. Not always accurate. Again, I'll explain why later on. 35 gigabits of traffic a second. Again, we estimate probably between 5 and 7, but the bigger numbers make them seem that more important. So what do we do about it? Well, the initial response was to panic, but then quickly form a crisis management team. And the way we find that works best is not just have networks involved, but have the people who build the websites, people who support and deliver the websites, the people who are looking at new technologies, basically to look at the range of options available to us. Whiteboard those, keep the customer, keep the people updated, so people know what's happening. And really, there's three solutions. The first is to block or disable the attacking platforms at source. Quite easy if it's one or two in a distributed denial of service attack. Actually, we're not really going to block 10,000 addresses. Rebuild the web service to cope with the additional workloads. Again, useful in the long term, but not an immediate mitigation. Or filter the service while allowing legitimate requests. So, where we were. We had the customer website, fairly standard stack, through an internet connection, and an average user wanting to connect to it. But then a range of attackers hitting that site, bringing it down. So our proposed solution was to implement, in effect, a proxy service in the cloud. Put in a load balancer and put in a couple of security proxy servers in. We would then move the customer's domain across so it was pointing at the cloud service and rename the existing cloud service to a new URL that was only accessible from that cloud service. We then found that all the traffic moved across to hit that web service. We allowed legitimate requests through from the proxy, whereas everything else got shunted into a black hole. In terms of how we implemented that, we worked with AWS, mainly because we already had experience of using that service for dev and test environments. But as well, they have a significant infrastructure of the like that probably only Janet can claim to compete with. I think a current analysis estimates that their backbone is in excess of 600 gigabits a second, which isn't quite Janet scale, but they're working on it. And as well, something that was released actually just before this attack happened, they have a marketplace, which means you can go along, there are pre-built applications, whether that's web servers or CMS, or in our case, security servers that are pre-built. You can just deploy them as you would any other web service and get them up and run quickly. So we looked, AI Cache is one that we chose. It seemed to deliver the functionality required. It was available in the marketplace. It was quick to set up. And more importantly for us, although the license for that is typically a big five-figure sum, not that quite that big. It was available on a pay-as-you-go basis. So the design and implementation of that was done within about 4 hours. We made some continual tweaks to that over the next 2 weeks, but effectively, that was how quick Amazon allows you to deploy things. So this is the traffic profile. As you can see, this is the number of HTTP requests we were experiencing as part of the DDoS. These were the number of malformed ones. And this was the legitimate traffic that was getting drowned out. As you can see, when we actually turned on the denial of service about 10 o'clock that night, what we saw is the total HTTP requests and the good HTTP requests mirror each other, and the bad then dropped to zero. So from our point of view, that enabled us to pick up the malformed part of the attack. So that was dropping a lot of the open packets and so on. The second thing we did, because that didn't cure all of it, we were still getting a distributed denial of service attack, which meant that there were what appeared to be legitimate requests, just an awful lot of them coming from a number of servers, is we enabled IP throttling. Now, this is a slightly more harsh measure, because if somebody's actually using the site, or if somebody's coming from an institution that proxies everything through a single request, they're at risk of being throttled. But it was a compromise we worked with the customer to agree on. And again, you can see it has quite a big impact on reducing load. So this is when we started testing the throttling. We turned it on just to see what would happen. That's when we turned it off again. And that's when we turned it back on again properly. So again, we reduced the volume of traffic by about 99%, pretty much all of which was the bad traffic. So customers continue to get through to the site. Doesn't give you a perfect solution. Proxying introduces all range of problems if your website's not particularly well designed. And there's also big issues around what you do with HTTPS. The big question being where you drop the certificate and do the decryption. Do you do that in the cloud and re-encrypt? Do you keep it coming through uninspected? So that's on a case-by-case basis. But you can see, this was the time of the DDoS, really heavy spikes. After that, we see a typical service profile. So the big peaks, Monday to Friday, weekends a bit quieter. And that bigger peak on the right-hand side was just when an announcement was made regarding a particular piece of legislation. So as we can see, it's an effective, and during all this time, so all the time on the right-hand side, the attack carried on. As I mentioned before, there was lots of calls of Tango down, saying the website was down. Actually, what you were finding is that they were trying to hack the site. They were again blocked by the IP throttling, and they thought they brought the site down. So don't believe everything you say. The site was actually working. We could test that with various people. So the cost of doing that costs about 350 quid. AWS has a great pricing model for this sort of thing. Their inbound costs are free. So it doesn't matter how much stuff is put in against it, bring it on. They charge for outbound, but that's fine because we're filtering everything we put outbound to just the legitimate stuff. So we got charged for 150 quid of data transfer outbound, two large VMs running the AI cache stuff, 100 gig of storage for log files. We could do some analysis and work with the police afterwards to do some analysis on this. And the licensing for AI cache, again, about $280 over 14 days. People cost about 25,000 when you look at all the time and effort involved in the consultancy, doing the analysis, not only during the attack, but doing the forensic investigation with NICU afterwards to try and capture enough evidential information that could be used if they've actually found whoever did this. And then, of course, there's the indirect costs, which are what happens to the customer. That is a guess. I suspect it's probably an underestimate because it's a lot of disruption for customers, not just the one that's impacted. So, lessons learned. Firstly, bandwidth is king. Whoever has the most wins, simple as that. But Janet are in a pretty good place compared to most ISP links. Most of the big organizations have at least 1 gig, probably 10. But you know, for commercial links and so on, that can be maybe 100 meg for some organizations. You're never going to outcome or outfight a big DDoS attack. So build up your relationship with your upstream network providers. Janet have a great team. Everyone knows that the Janet network is probably one of the best in the world. Make sure you know who to talk to there. So if you start seeing an attack, you can get through to cert, you can get through to the people you need to speak to quickly. They can start doing throttling and upstream analysis because you won't always have the bandwidth in-house to handle that sort of attack. And don't forget your non-Janet links. I think most universities now have some sort of commercial connectivity, often at a far lower thing. So think about who you buy that from. Start talking and buying beers for the guys who respond to you at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning. So, second thing, DNS flexibility is vital. If you've got your DNS architected well, you can do the sort of changes we made, which was to move URLs around to start readdressing services. If you don't, then none of this will work. If you keep all your DNS servers in the same network connection and that network connection goes down, then you're effectively offline. Make sure you have a diverse route into your DNS so you can actually manage that. And try and keep at least one DNS server on a completely separate network. Yeah, possibly off-site, possibly in the cloud, somewhere else. It doesn't necessarily have to be running all your services, just your core services that are available. Building your own works, I don't recommend it. It's a bit stressful. There are lots of people out there now that do that. simply, if you look at Amazon, for example, there are lots of services on there. But there are two in particular that I know have got press. I'm not recommending either of them because I haven't used either of them. But Cloudflare gets a lot of good press, and I'm pretty sure is free for basic services. Imperva is another service. From our point of view, from EduServe's point of view, is quite important because they're listed on gCloud and hence have always sort of been along the government accreditation process. And that's it. So I may have caught up on our time a little bit, but time for questions or comments.
Of course I have a question. First of all, did you see any application layer attacks? So actually attacking the application, not just in the HTTP. And second of all, did you see them try and go actually after the IP addresses rather than the URLs?
The answer to both questions is no, fortunately. So the attack was quite simplistic in its approach. Although they used a range of options, those options were pretty straightforward. At one stage, we thought they were trying to hit one of the, in effect, the admin servers, but that appeared to be actually just a bad link on a web page that they were hitting. So we did some analysis on that. We don't believe they tried to actually go after the application layer. In terms of what happens if they hit the IP address, I'll be honest with you, at that stage, I don't know. Luckily, they didn't. I remember thinking at the time as we moved this across, all they had to do was think about what the original IP address was. Even though we moved it to a new network, again, it doesn't take a huge amount of skill to go on to Whois and start looking up network block names and trying to then target that, which is why I said, you know, there are mitigations you can put in place, but ultimately, your upstream provider relationship is key. One of the things we did find is by implementing a proxy service, what you can actually start doing is also caching your infrastructure as well. That doesn't work for every type of site, but certainly we kept a 10-minute cache of all the pages on there. So even if they had hit the underlying IP infrastructure, taken it down, people would have still seen a read-only copy of the site, and then we could have kept that copy in cache. Exactly. So in effect, distributing your front end across as many high bandwidth networks as possible. And if you look, you know, there are already organizations that can do that, things like Akamai, Amazon's CloudFront, and so on, offer those type of capabilities. So you just push your core content up into a content distribution network. Then you don't have to worry if your main infrastructure goes down because there are copies out there. Again, long term, you have to better update those, but most denial of services don't last forever. It's an interesting one. Yes, but there's, I suppose, if it's a legitimate protest, then make those protests yourself. Don't rely on an aggregated network of compromised machines that you don't control. So it's the equivalent of you going out on a march as opposed to trying to get 5,000 people you pay to go out on a march for you. It's a very political question. I'm in two minds about this. The strange thing was the piece of legislation that they were targeting was actually, it was a bit nonsensical because they completely misinterpreted the reason for the legislation. But that aside, I think it's an interesting question. Yes, there are digital protests, but they also have to accept the fact that what they were doing is illegal. We have to take measures to counter that. And then because of the costs involved and because our customers were impacted, and I think, you know, I don't think I'm speaking just for EduServe and saying this, I think most ISPs and most hosting providers will try and stop and actively prosecute people who do denial of service attacks because it has a big financial and service implication.
Yeah,
to look up the legal and sociological background, good papers by Martina Gillen at Brooks University, on whether there should be a right to digital protest, as there is a right to arrange a march down Whitehall.
I think there's, as you said, there's a significant distinction between people using botnets and then people who use volunteer machines to protest.
Yeah, and certainly tools like low orbit ion cannon, high orbit ion cannon make no attempt to hide where the source is coming from. So, yeah, you know, we could see who the attackers were. We could see the range of networks they were coming from. Effectively, it's a free protest. No one's going to ever prosecute 5,000 or 10,000 users. But I mean, there are going to be times when, you know, there may be a three strikes rule in the future. There may be automated ways of reporting this. But, you know, effectively, it's very difficult to challenge somebody that were making a denial of service attack when they're trying to load a page on a website. It's very difficult to prosecute somebody for that. Actually, we saw performance improve. Like I said, the underlying website was a legacy system and not particularly optimized or efficient. Basically, the proxy handled an issue that the website didn't, which was it cached all the static assets like images and PDFs and so on. So we saw a performance improvement for that. Where we saw issues was around two things. One was HTTPS. So what we decided to do in the end was move the cert into the cloud, re-encrypt, going back to a new cert, and then once the attack was over, reissuing a new cert so that there was no risk of the private key being compromised in the cloud. Second thing we saw was the fact, because of the caching, some of the pages that loaded, it was said, you know, click here if you're this type of person, and then the type of content that would be displayed would be dependent on the cookie that was set. Because the cookie is dynamic, it's quite difficult to cache. So do you allow that or not? AI caches some quite interesting and very detailed configuration options to allow for that. It took us probably 3 or 4 days after the initial implementation to tune that to the point where we were happy with the way the site was performing. But in general, for performance, there is definitely no negative impact and probably a positive impact.
Thank you very much
indeed. Thank you.
I'm not sure whether the question of legitimate digital protest is a topic for a lightning talk, but it might be. Okay, I can't find you. There you are, Henry. Final speaker in the session is my colleague Henry Hughes, who has worked for Janet for even longer than I have. He's part of the Strategic Technologies Group, looking at future developments of what Janet can do. Recently, he's been looking at things around access management, around higher assurance provision of networking, and security, which is what he's going to talk about today. So.
Thanks, Andrew. Good morning, everybody. I'm aware that I'm between you and your tea and refreshment break, so we will finish on time. Having said that, I'm happy to take questions either as we go. I've got some questions for you at the beginning and the end.
This recording was brought to you by Janet Training as part of NetWorkshop Online. Further information is available on our website at www.ja.net/training.